I'll tell you how I knew your name if you explain to me what that shape is that you have in your journal.
Tell me why we're negotiating with terrorists, Ronan asked.
Since when am I a terrorist? Demanded Blue. Seems to me I came bringing something you guys wanted, and you're being dicks.
Not all of us, Adam said.
I'm not being a dick, Gansey said. He was uncomfortable with the idea that she might not like him.
Now what is this thing you want to know?
Blue reached her hand out.
Hold on, I'll show you what I mean.
Gansey let her take the journal again. Leafing through the pages, she turned it to him so that she could see the one in question. The page detailed an artifact he'd found in Pennsylvania. He'd also doodled on it in several places.
I believe that is a man chasing a car, Gansey said.
Not that. This. She pointed to one of the other doodles.
They're ley lines. He stretched out a hand for the journal. For a strange, hyper-aware moment, he realized how closely she watched him as he took it. He didn't think it missed her notice how his left hand curved familiarly around the leather binding, how the thumb and finger on his right hand knew just how much pressure to apply to coax the pages to spread where he wanted them to. The journal and Gansey were clearly long acquainted, and he wanted her to know.
This is me, the real me.
He didn't want to analyze the source of this impulse too hard. He focused on flipping through the journal instead. It took him no time at all to find the desired page, a map of the United States marked all over with curving lines. He traced a finger over one line that stretched through New York City and Washington, D.C., another intersecting line that stretched from Boston to St. Louis, a third that cut horizontally across the first two, stretching through Virginia and Kentucky and on west. There was, as always, something satisfying about tracing the lines, something that called to mind scavenger hunts and childhood drawings. These are the three main lines, Gansey said, the ones that seem to matter.
Seem to matter how?
How much of this did you read?
Some. A lot. Most.
He continued. The ones that seem to matter as far as finding Glendower. That line across Virginia is the one that connects us to the UK, the United Kingdom. She rolled her eyes dramatically enough that he caught the gesture without turning his head.
I know what the UK is, thanks. The public school system isn't that bad.
He'd managed to offend again, with no effort at all. He concurred. Surely not. Those other two lines have a lot of reports of unusual sightings on them, of paranormal stuff. Poltergeists, and mothmen, and black dogs. But his hesitation was unnecessary. Blue didn't scoff.
My mother drew that shape, she said. The ley lines. So did
one of the other women here. They didn't know what it was, though, only that it would be significant. That's why I wanted to know.
Now you, Ronan said to Blue.
I saw Gansey's spirit, she said. I've never seen one before. I don't see things like that, but this time I did. I asked you your name, and you told me Gansey. That's all there is. Honestly, it's part of the reason why I wanted to come along today.
This answer satisfied Gansey fairly well. She was, after all, the daughter of a psychic, and it matched the account his recorder gave, though it struck him as a partial answer. Ronan demanded,
"Saw him where?"
While I was sitting outside with one of my half-aunts.
This seemed to satisfy Ronan as well, because he asked,
"What's the other half of her?"
"God, Ronan," Adam said,
"enough."
There was a moment of tense silence, occupied only by the continuous droning whine of the helicopter. They were waiting, Gansey knew, for his verdict. Did he believe her answer? Did he think they should follow her directions? Did he trust her? Her voice was on the recorder. He felt like he didn't have a choice. What he was thinking, but didn't want to say with Helen listening in, was, "You're right, Ronan. It's starting. Something's starting." He was also thinking, "Tell me what you think of her, Adam. Tell me why you trust her. Don't make me decide for once. I don't know if I'm right." But what he said was,
"I'm going to need everyone to be straight with each other from now on. No more games. This isn't just for Blue, either. All of us."
Ronan said, "I'm always straight."
Adam replied. Oh, man, that's the biggest lie you've ever told.
Blue said, okay.
Gansey suspected that none of them was being completely honest with their replies, but at least he'd told them what he wanted. Sometimes, all he could hope for was getting it on the record. The headsets fell silent as Adam, Blue, and Gansey all stared intently out the window. Below them was green and more green, everything toy-like and quaint from this height, a place set of velvet fields and broccoli trees.
What are we looking for? Helen asked.
Gansey said, the usual.
What's the usual? Blue asked.
The usual, more often than not, turned out to be acres of nothing, but Gansey said, sometimes the ley lines are marked in ways that are visible from the air. Like in the UK, some of the lines are marked with horses carved into hillsides.
He'd been in a small fixed-wing plane with Mallory the first time that he'd seen the Uffington horse, a 300-foot horse scraped into the side of an English chalk hill. Like everything associated with the ley lines, the horse was not quite ordinary. The horse was stretched and stylized, an elegant, eerie silhouette that was more suggestion of a horse than actual horse.
Tell her about Nazca, murmured Adam.
Oh, right, Gansey said. Even though Blue had read much of the journal, there was a lot that wasn't in it, and unlike Ronan and Adam and Noah, she hadn't lived this life for the past year. It was suddenly difficult not to be excited by the idea of explaining it all to her. The story always sounded more plausible when he laid all of the facts out at once. He continued, in Peru, there are hundreds of lines cut into the ground in the shapes of things like birds and monkeys and men and imaginary creatures. Thousands of years old, but they only make sense from the air, from an airplane. They're too big to see from the ground. When you're standing next to them, they just look like scraped footpaths.
You've seen them in person, Blue said.
When Gansey had seen the Nazca lines for himself, massive and strange and symmetrical, he'd known that he wouldn't be able to give up until he found Glendower. The scale of the lines was what had struck him first. Hundreds upon hundreds of feet of curious drawings in the middle of the desert. He'd been stunned by the precision. The drawings were mathematical in their perfection, faultless in their symmetry. And the last thing to hit him, right in his gut, was the emotional impact, a mysterious raw ache that wouldn't go away. Gansey felt like he couldn't survive not knowing if the lines meant something. That was the only part of his hunt for Glendower that he could never seem to explain to people.
Gansey, Adam said, what's that there?
The helicopter slowed as all four passengers craned their necks. By now, they were deep into the mountains, and the ground had risen to meet them. All around them were rippling flanks of mysterious green forests, a rolling dark sea from above. Among the slopes and gullies, however, was a slanting, green-carpeted field marked by a pale fracture of lines.
"Does it make a shape?" he asked.
"Helen, stop! Stop!"
"Do you think this is a bicycle?" demanded Helen, but the helicopter's forward progress stopped.
"Look," Adam said. "There's a wing there. And there, a beak. A bird?"
"No," Ronan said, voice cold and even. "Not just a bird. It's a raven."
Slowly the form became clear to Gansey, emerging from the overgrown grass. A bird, yes, neck twisted backward and wings pressed as if in a book. Tail feathers splayed and claws simplified. Ronan was right. Even stylized, the dome of the head, the generous curve of the beak, and the ruffle of feathers on its neck made the bird unmistakably a raven. His skin prickled.
"Put the helicopter down," Gansey said immediately.
Helen replied, "I can't land on private property." He cast an entreating gaze at his sister. He needed to write down the GPS coordinates. He needed to take a photo for his records. He needed to sketch the shape of it in his journal. More than anything, he needed to touch the lines of the bird and make it real in his head.
"Helen, 2 seconds."
Her return look was knowing. It was the sort of condescending look that might have caused arguments when he was younger and more easily riled. If the landowner discovers me there and decides to press charges, I could lose my license.
2 seconds. You saw? There's no one around here for miles and miles. No houses.
Helen's gaze was very level. I'm supposed to be at Mom and Dad's in 2 hours.
2 seconds.
Finally, she rolled her eyes and sat back in her seat. Shaking her head, she turned back toward the controls.
Thank you, Helen, Adam said.
2 seconds, she repeated grimly. If you aren't done by then, I'm taking off without you. The helicopter landed 15 feet away from the strange raven's heart.
23.
As soon as the helicopter had touched down, Gansey leapt from the cabin and strode into the thigh-high grass as if he owned the place, Ronan by his side. Through the open door of the helo, Blue heard him say Noah's name to the phone before repeating the GPS coordinates for the field. He was energized and powerful, a king in his castle. Blue, on the other hand, was a little slower. For a multitude of reasons, her legs felt a little gelled after flying. She wasn't sure if not telling Gansey the entire truth about St. Mark's Eve was the right decision, and she was worried about Ronan trying to speak to her again. It smelled wonderful in the middle of this field, though. All grass and trees and somewhere water, and lots of it. Blue thought she might live here quite happily. Beside her, Adam shielded his eyes. He looked at home here. His hair the same colorless brown as the tips of old grass, and he looked more handsome than Blue remembered. She thought about how Adam had taken her hand earlier, and considered how much she'd like for him to do it again. With some surprise, Adam said, "Those lines are pretty invisible from here." He was right, of course. Though Blue had just seen the raven as they touched down beside it, whatever geographical feature had made the shape was now completely hidden. I still hate flying. Sorry about Ronan. The flying part wasn't bad, Blue said. Actually, aside from Ronan, she had kind of liked it. The sense of floating in a very noisy bubble where all directions were possible. I thought it would be worse. You sort of have to give up control, don't you? And then it's okay. Now Ronan, he's a pit bull, Adam said. I know some really nice pit bulls. One of the dogs Blue walked each week was a cow-printed pit bull with as nice a smile as you could hope for in a canine.
He's the kind of pit that makes the evening news. Gansey's trying to retrain him.
How noble.
It makes him feel better about being Gansey.
Blue didn't doubt it.
Sometimes he's very condescending.
Adam looked at the ground.
He doesn't mean to be. It's all that blue blood in his veins.
He was about to say something else when a shout interrupted him.
Are you listening, Glendower? I am coming to find you.
Gansey's voice, ebullient and ringing, echoed off the tree-covered slopes around the field. Adam and Blue found him standing in the middle of a clear, pale path, his arms stretched out and his head tilted back as he shouted into the air. Adam's mouth made the soundless shape of a laugh.
Gansey grinned at them both. He was hard to resist in this form, glowing with rows and rows of white teeth, a college brochure in the making.
Oyster shells, he said, leaning to pick up one of the pale objects that made up the path. The fragment was pure white, the edges blunt and worn. That's what makes up the raven, like they use for roads down in the Tidewater area. Oyster shells on bare rock. What do you think of that?
I think that's a lot of oyster shells to bring from the coast, Adam replied. I also think Glendower would have come from the coast, too.
Gansey pointed at Adam by way of a reply. Blue put her hands on her hips.
So you think they put Glendower's body on a boat in Wales, sailed over to Virginia, then brought him up to the mountains? Why?
Energy, Gansey replied. Rummaging in his bag, he removed a small black box that looked a lot like a very small car battery. Blue asked, "What's that? It looks expensive." He twiddled with switches on the side as he explained,
"An electromagnetic frequency meter. It monitors energy levels. Some people use them for ghost hunting. It's supposed to have a high reading when you're near a spirit.
but it's also supposed to read high when you're near an energy source, like a ley line. She scowled at the gadget. A box to register magic seemed to insult both the box holder and magic. And of course, you have an electromagnetic button thing. Everyone has one of them. Gansey held the meter above his head as if he were calling aliens. You find it not normal? She could tell that he very much wanted her to say that he wasn't normal, so she replied, Oh, I'm sure it's quite normal in some circles. He looked a little hurt, but most of his attention was on the meter, which showed two faint red lights. He remarked, I'd like to be in those circles. So, like I said, energy. One of the other names for the ley line is Corpse. Corpse Road, Blue interrupted. I know. He looked pleased and magnanimous, as if she were a prize pupil. So school me. You probably know better than I. As before, his accent was the broad, glorious old Virginia accent, and Blue's words felt clumsy beside him. I just know that the dead travel in straight lines, she said, that they used to carry corpses in straight lines to churches to bury them, along what you call the ley line. It was supposed to be really bad to take them any other route than the way they'd choose to travel as a spirit. Right, he said. So it stands to reason there's something about the line that fortifies or protects a corpse. The soul, the animus, the quiddity of it. Gansey, seriously, Adam interrupted to Blue's relief. Nobody knows what quiddity is. The whatness, Adam. Whatever it is that makes a person what they are. If they removed Glendower from the Corpse Road, I think the magic that keeps him asleep would be disrupted. She said, Basically, you mean he would die for good if he was removed from the line? Yes, Gansey said. The blinking lights on his machine had begun to flash more heavily, leading them over the raven's beak and toward the tree line where Ronan already stood. Blue lifted her arms up so the heads of the grass wouldn't hit the backs of her hands. It was up to her waist in some places. She asked, And why not just leave him in Wales? Isn't that where they want him to wake up and be a hero? It was an uprising, and he was a traitor to the English crown, Gansey said. The easy way that he began the story, at once striding through grass and eyeing the EMF reader, let Blue know that he had told it many times before. Glendower fought the English for years, and it was ugly, all struggle between noble families with mixed allegiances. The Welsh resistance failed. Glendower disappeared. If the English had known where he was, dead or alive, there's no way they'd treat his body the way the Welsh wanted it treated. Haven't you heard of being hung, drawn, and quartered? Blue asked, Is it as painful as conversations with Ronan? Gansey cast a glance over to Ronan, who was a small, indistinct form by the trees. Adam audibly swallowed a laugh. Depends on if Ronan is sober, Gansey answered. Adam asked, What is he doing, anyway? Peeing. Trust Lynch to deface a place like this 5 minutes after getting here. Deface, marking his territory. He must own more of Virginia than your father, then. I don't think he's ever used an indoor toilet, now that I consider it. This all seemed very manly and Aglinby to Blue, this calling of one another by last names and bantering about outdoor urinary habits. It also seemed like it could go on for a long time, so she interrupted, changing the subject back to Glendower. They'd really go to all this trouble to hide his body? Gansey said, Well, Ned Kelly. He delivered the nonsensical statement so matter-of-factly that Blue felt abruptly stupid, as if maybe the public school system really was lacking. Then Adam said, with a glance toward Blue, Nobody knows who Ned Kelly is either, Gansey. Really? Gansey asked, so innocently startled by this that it was clear that Adam had been right before. He hadn't meant to be condescending. He was an Australian outlaw. When the British caught him, they did awful things with his body. I think the chief of police used his head as a paperweight for a while. Just think what Glendower's enemies would do to him. If the Welsh wanted a shot at Glendower being resurrected, they would have wanted his body unmolested. Why the mountains, then? Blue insisted. Why isn't he right on the shore? This seemed to remind Gansey of something, because instead of replying to her, He turned to Adam. I called Mallory about that ritual to see if he'd tried it. He said he didn't think it could be performed just anywhere on the ley line. He guessed it had to be done on the heart of it, where the most energy is. I'm thinking that someplace like that is also where they'd want Glendower. Adam turned to Blue. What about your energy? The question took her by surprise. What? You said that you made things louder for other psychics, Adam said. Is that about energy? Blue was absurdly pleased that he remembered, and also absurdly pleased that he'd replied to her instead of Gansey, who was now swatting gnats out of his eyes and waiting for her response. Yes, she said. I guess I make things that need energy stronger. I'm like a walking battery. You're the table everyone wants at Starbucks, Gansey mused as he began to walk again. Blue blinked. What? Over his shoulder, Gansey said, next to the wall plug. He pressed the EMF reader into the side of a tree and observed both objects with great interest. Adam shook his head at Blue. To Gansey, he said, I'm saying that she could maybe turn a regular part of the ley line into a doable place for the ritual. Wait, are we going in the woods? What about Helen? It hasn't been 2 seconds, Gansey said, although it clearly had been. That's an interesting idea about the energy. Though, can your battery get drained by things other than conversations about prostitution? She didn't dignify this comment with an immediate response. Instead, she thought about how her mother had said there was nothing to fear from the dead, and how Neve had seemed disbelieving. The church watch had obviously taken something from her. Maybe there were worse consequences that she had yet to discover. Well, this is interesting, Gansey remarked. He straddled a tiny stream at the very edge of the trees. It was really just water that had bubbled up from an underground source soaking the grass. Gansey's attention was focused entirely on the EMF reader he held directly above the water. The meter was pegged. Helen, Adam said warningly. Ronan had rejoined them, and both boys looked in the direction of the helicopter. I said, this is interesting, Gansey repeated. And I said, Helen, just a couple of yards. She'll be angry. Gansey's expression was baleful, and Blue could see immediately that Adam wouldn't hold out against it. I did tell you, Adam said. The stream trickled sluggishly out of the woods from between 2 diamond-barked dogwoods. With Gansey in the lead, they all followed the water into the trees. Immediately, the temperature dropped several degrees. Blue hadn't realized how much insect noise there was in the field until it was replaced by occasional bird song under the trees. This was a beautiful old wood, all massive oak and ash trees finding footing among great slabs of cracked stone. Fern sprang from rocks, and verdant moss grew up the sides of the tree trunks. The air itself was scented with green and growing and water. The light was golden through the leaves. Everything was alive, alive. She breathed. This is lovely. It was for Adam, not Gansey, but she saw Gansey glance over his shoulder at her. Beside him, Ronan was curiously muted, something about his posture defensive. What are we even looking for? Adam asked. Gansey was a bloodhound, the EMF reader leading him along the widening stream. The moving water had become too wide to straddle, and now it ran in a bed of pebbles and sharp fragments of rock and, strangely enough, a few of the oyster shells. What we're always looking for, Adam warned. Helen is going to hate you. She'll text me if she gets too mad, Gansey said. To demonstrate, he slid his phone out of his pocket. Oh, there's no signal. Given their location in the mountains, the lack of signal was unsurprising, but Gansey stopped short. While the four of them made an uneven circle, he thumbed through the screens on his phone. In his other hand, the EMF reader glowed solid red. His voice sounded a little strange when he asked, "Is anyone else wearing a watch?" Weekends were not generally days of precise timing for Blue, so she was not, and Ronan had only his few knotted leather strands around his arm. Adam lifted his wrist. He wore a cheap-looking watch with a grubby band. I am, he said, adding ruefully, but it doesn't seem to be working. Without speaking, Gansey turned the face of his phone to them. It was set to the clock function, and it took Blue a moment to realize that none of the hands were moving. For a long moment, the four of them just looked at the three still hands on the phone's clock face. Blue's heart marked off every second the clock didn't. "Is it?" Adam started and then stopped. He tried again. "Is it because the power is being affected from the energy of the line?" Ronan's voice was cutting. "Affecting your watch? Your wind-up watch?" "It's true," Gansey answered. "My phone's still on. So's the reader. It's only that the time has... I wonder if..." But there were no answers, and they all knew it. "I want to go on," Gansey said. "Just a little farther." He waited to see if they would stop him. No one said anything, but as Gansey set off again, clambering over the top of a slab of stone, Ronan beside him, Adam glanced at Blue. His expression asked, "Are you okay?" She was okay, but in the way she'd been okay before the helicopter. It was not that she was scared of flashing lights on the EMF reader or Adam's watch refusing to work, but she hadn't gotten out of bed in the morning expecting to encounter a place where possibly time didn't work. Blue stretched her hand out. Adam took it without hesitation, like he'd been waiting for her to offer it. He said in a low voice, just for her, "My heart is beating like crazy right now." Strangely enough, it was not his fingers twined in hers that affected Blue the strongest. It was where his warm wrist pressed against hers above their hands. "I need to tell him he can't kiss me," she thought. But not yet. Right now, she wanted to feel his skin pressed against hers, both of their pulses rapid and uncertain. Hand in hand, they climbed after Gansey. The trees grew even larger, some of them grown together into trunks like castles, turreted and huge. The canopy soared high overhead, rustling and reverent. Everything was green, green, green. Somewhere ahead, water splashed. For one brief moment, Blue thought she heard music. "Noah!" Gansey's voice sounded forlorn. He'd stopped by a mighty beech tree, and now he searched around himself. Catching up to him, Blue realized he'd stopped by the shore of a mountain pool that fed the stream they'd been following. The pool was only a few inches deep and perfectly clear. The water was so transparent that it begged to be touched. "I thought I heard..." Gansey broke off. His eyes dropped to where Adam held Blue's hand. Again, his face was somehow puzzled by the fact of their hand-holding. Adam's grip tightened, although she didn't think he meant for it to. This was a wordless discussion, too, though she didn't think either of the boys knew what they were trying to say. Gansey turned to the pool of water. In his hand, the EMF reader had gone dark. Crouching, he hovered his free hand over the water. His fingers were spread wide, millimeters from the surface. Beneath his hand, the water shifted and darkened, and Blue realized that there were 1,000 tiny fish just underneath. They flashed silver and then black as they moved, clinging to the faint shadow he cast. Adam asked, "How are there fish here?" The stream they'd followed into the woods was far too shallow for fish, and above them the pool seemed to be fed by rainfall from higher up the mountain. Fish didn't come from the sky. Gansey replied, "I don't know." The fish tumbled and coursed over one another, ceaselessly moving, tiny enigmas. Again, Blue thought she heard music, but when she looked at Adam, she thought perhaps it had just been the sound of his breathing. Gansey looked up to them, and she saw in his face that he loved this place. His bald expression held something new, not the raw delight of finding the ley line or the sly pleasure of teasing Blue. She recognized the strange happiness that came from loving something without knowing why you did, that strange happiness that was sometimes so big that it felt like sadness. It was the way she felt when she looked at the stars. Just like that, he was a little bit closer to the Gansey that Blue had seen in the churchyard, and she found she couldn't bear to look at him. Instead, she pulled her hand free from Adam to go to the beech tree Gansey stood beside. Carefully, she stepped over the exposed knots of the beech's roots, and then she laid her palm on its smooth gray bark. Like the tree behind her house, this beech's bark was as cold as winter and oddly comforting.
Adam? This was Ronan's voice, and she heard Adam's footsteps moving cautiously and slowly around the edge of the pool toward it. The sound of snapping branches became softer as he moved farther away.
I don't think these fish are real, Gansey said softly.
It was such a ridiculous thing to say that Blue turned to look at him again. He was tipping his hand back and forth as he watched the water.
I think they're here because I thought they ought to be here, Gansey said.
Blue replied sarcastically,
Okay, God. He twisted his hand again. She saw the fish's forms flash in the water once more. Hesitant, he went on, At the reading, what was it that the one woman said with the hair?
She said it was about perception.
No, intention.
Persephone.
Intention is for cards, Blue said.
That's for a reading, for letting someone into your head, to see patterns in the future and the past, not for fish. How could intention work on a fish? Life isn't negotiable.
He asked, What color were the fish when we arrived?
They'd been black and silver, or at least they had looked it in the reflection. Gansey, she was certain, was reaching for signs of inexplicable magic, but she wasn't going to be swayed so easily. Blue and brown could look black or silver, depending on the light. Nonetheless, she joined him, crouching in the moist dirt beside the pool. The fish were all dark and indistinct in the shadow of his hand.
I was watching them and wondering how they'd gotten here, and then I remembered that there was a kind of trout that often live in smaller creeks, Gansey said.
Wild brook trout, I think they're called.
I thought that would make a little more sense. Maybe they were introduced by man somehow in this pool or a pool farther up the stream.
That's what I was thinking. Brook trout are silver on top and red on the bottom.
Okay, she said. Gansey's outstretched hand was very still.
Tell me there were no red fish in this pool when we arrived.
When she didn't answer, he looked at her.
She shook her head. There'd definitely been no red.
He pulled his hand back quickly.
The tiny school of fish darted and leapt for cover, but not before Blue saw that every one of them was silver and red. Not a little red, but bright red. Sunset red. Red as a dream. Like they had never been any other color.
I don't understand, Blue said.
Something in her ached, though, like she did understand, but couldn't put words to it, wrap her thoughts around it. She felt like she was a part of a dream this place was having, or it was a part of a dream of hers.
I don't either.
They both turned their head at the same time, then, at the sound of a voice from their left.
Was that Adam?
Blue asked. It seemed strange that she had to ask, but nothing felt very definite.
Again they heard Adam's voice, more clearly this time.
He and Ronan stood on the other side of the pool. Just behind him was an oak tree. A man-sized rotten cavity gaped blackly in its trunk. In the pool at his feet was a reflection of both Adam and the tree, the mirror image colder and more distant than reality.
Adam rubbed his arms fiercely as if chilled.
Ronan stood beside him, looking over his shoulder at something Blue couldn't see.
Come here, Adam said, and stand in there, and tell me if I'm losing my mind.
His accent was pronounced, which Blue was beginning to learn meant that he was too bothered to hide it.
Blue peered at the cavity. Like all holes in trees, it looked moist and uneven and black, the fungus in the bark still working away at enlarging the crater. The edges of the entrance were jagged and thin, making the tree's continued survival seem miraculous.
Are you okay? Gansey asked.
Close your eyes, Adam told him.
His arms were crossed, his hands gripping his biceps.
The way he was breathing reminded Blue of what it felt like to wake after a nightmare, heart pounding, breath snagging, legs aching from a chase you never really ran.
After you stand in there, I mean.
Did you go in there? Gansey asked Ronan, who shook his head.
He's the one who pointed it out, Adam said.
Ronan said, flat as a board, I'm not going in there. When he said it, it sounded like principle instead of cowardice, like his refusal to take a card at the reading.
I don't mind, Blue said. I'll go. It was hard for her to imagine being intimidated when surrounded by a tree, no matter how strange the forest around it might be. Stepping into the cavity, she turned so that she faced the outside world. The air inside the cavity smelled damp and close. It was warm, too, and although Blue knew it must be because of the rotting process, it made the tree seem as warm-blooded as her. In front of her, Adam's arms were still gripped around himself. What does he think will happen in here? She closed her eyes. Almost at once, she could smell rain. Not the scent of rain coming, but the living, shifting odor of a storm currently waging. The wide-open scent of a breeze moving through water. Then she became aware that something was touching her face. When she opened her eyes, she was both in her body and watching it, nowhere near the cavity of the tree. The Blue that was before her stood inches away from a boy in an Aglimby sweater. There was a slight stoop to his posture, and his shoulders were spattered darkly with rain. It was his fingers that Blue felt on her face. He touched her cheeks with the backs of his fingers. Tears coursed down the other Blue's face. Through some strange magic, Blue could feel them on her face as well. She could feel, too, the sick, rising misery she'd felt in the churchyard, the grief that felt bigger than her. The other Blue's tears seemed endless. One drop slid after another, each following an identical path down her cheeks. The boy in the Aglimby sweater leaned his forehead against Blue's. She felt the pressure of his skin against hers, and suddenly she could smell mint. It'll be okay, Gansey told the other Blue. She could tell that he was afraid. It'll be okay. Impossibly, Blue realized that this other Blue was crying because she loved Gansey, and that the reason Gansey touched her like that, his fingers so careful with her, was because he knew that her kiss could kill him. She could feel how badly the other Blue wanted to kiss him, even as she dreaded it. Though she couldn't understand why, her real present-day memories in the tree cavity were clouded with other false memories of their lips nearly touching, a life this other Blue had already lived. Okay, I'm ready. Gansey's voice caught just a little. Blue, kiss me. Shaken, Blue opened her eyes for real, and now she saw the darkness of the cavity around her and smelled the dark, rotten scent of the tree again. Her guts were twisted with the ghostly grief and desire she'd felt in the vision. She was sick and embarrassed, and when she stepped out of the tree, she couldn't look at Gansey. Well? Gansey asked. She said, it's something. When she didn't elucidate further, he took her place in the tree. It had seemed so very real. Was this the future? Was this an alternate future? Was this just a waking dream? She couldn't imagine falling in love with Gansey of all people, but in that vision, it had seemed not just plausible, but indisputable. As Gansey turned inside the cavity, Adam took her arm and dragged her closer. He wasn't gentle, but Blue didn't think he meant to be rough. She did startle, though, when he wiped her face with the heel of his other hand. She had been crying real tears. I want you to know, Adam whispered furiously, I would never do that. It wasn't real. I'd never do that to him. His fingers were tight on her arm, and she felt him shaking. Blue blinked at Adam, wiping her cheeks dry. It took her a moment to realize that he must have seen something entirely different than she had. But if she asked him what he had seen, she'd have to tell him what she saw. Ronan was staring at them, raw, as if he knew what had happened in the tree, even without attempting it himself. A few feet away in the cavity, Gansey's head was bowed. He looked like a statue in a church, his hands clasped in front of him. There was something very ancient about him just then, with the tree arched over him and his eyelids rendered colorless in the shadows. He was himself, but he was something else, too. That something that Blue had first seen in him at the boy's reading, that sense of otherness, of something more, seemed to radiate from that still portrait of Gansey enshrined in the dark tree. Adam's face was turned away, and now Blue knew what his expression was, shame. Whatever he had seen in his vision in the hollowed tree, he was certain Gansey was seeing it too, and he couldn't bear it. Gansey's eyes flicked open. "What did you see?" Blue asked. He cocked his head. It was a slow, dreamlike gesture. Gansey said, "I saw Glendower."
24.
As Adam had warned, it had not taken 2 seconds to explore the raven cut into the ground, follow the creek into the woods, watch the fish change colors, discover a hallucinatory tree, and return to Helen. According to Gansey's watch, it had taken 7 minutes. Helen had been furious. When Gansey told her that 7 minutes was a miracle and really they should have been gone 40, it had caused such an argument that Ronan, Adam, and Blue had removed their headphones to allow the siblings to duke it out. Without the headphones, of course, the three of them in the rear seat were robbed of the power of speech. It should have created an awkward silence, but instead, it was easier without words.
"It's impossible," Blue said the moment the helicopter had left the lot quiet enough to speak. "Time couldn't have stopped while we were in the woods."
"Not impossible," Gansey replied, crossing the parking lot to the building. He ripped open the door to Monmouth's first floor and shouted up into the dim stairwell, "Noah, are you home?"
"It's true," Adam said. "According to leyline theory, time can be a fluid thing right on the line."
It was one of the more commonly reported effects of ley lines, especially in Scotland. In Scottish folklore, there was a long-held myth that travelers could be pixie-led, or led astray by territorial fairies. Hikers would set out along a straight trail only to find themselves inexplicably lost, standing in a location they had no recollection of walking to, yards or miles away from their starting point, their watch showing minutes before or hours after they'd left, like they tripped on a wrinkle in space-time. The ley line's energy playing tricks.
"What about that thing in the tree?" Blue asked. "Was that a hallucination? A dream?"
"Glendower. It was Glendower, Glendower, Glendower." Gansey couldn't stop seeing it. He felt excited or scared or both.
"I don't know," he said. He pulled out his keys and swatted Ronan's hand away when he snatched for them. It would be a cold, cold day in a Virginia summer when Ronan was allowed to drive his car. He'd seen what Ronan did to his own car, and the idea of what he'd do with a few dozen more horsepower at his command was unthinkable. "But I intend to find out. Come on, let's go."
"Go? Where?" Blue asked.
"Prison," Gansey said agreeably. The other two boys were already jostling her toward the pig. He felt high as a kite, euphoric.
"The dentist, someplace awful."
"I have to be back by..." But she trailed off.
"I don't know when. Sometime reasonable?"
"What's reasonable?" Adam asked, and Ronan laughed.
"We'll get you back before you turn into a pumpkin." Gansey was about to add Blue to the end of this statement, but it felt strange to call her that.
"Is Blue a nickname?"
Beside the Camaro, Blue's eyebrows got suddenly pointy.
Hurriedly, Gansey added, "Not that it's not a cool name, just that it's unusual."
"Weird ass." This was from Ronan, but he said it as he chewed absently on one of the leather straps on his wrist so the effect was minimized.
Blue replied, "Unfortunately, it's nothing normal. Not like Gansey."
He smiled tolerantly at her. Rubbing his smooth chin with its recently assassinated chin hairs, he studied her. She barely came up to Ronan's shoulder, but she was every bit as big as he, every bit as present. Gansey had a sense of incredible rightness then, with everyone assembled by the pig. Like Blue, not the ley line was the missing piece that he'd been needing all these years. Like the search for Glendower wasn't truly underway until she was part of it. She was right like Ronan had been right, like Adam had been right, like Noah had been right. When each of them had joined him, he'd felt a rush of relief. And in the helicopter, he'd felt exactly the same way when he'd realized it was her voice on the recorder. Of course, she could still walk away.
"She won't," he thought. "She has to feel it, too."
He said, "I've always liked the name Jane."
Blue's eyes widened.
"Jane? What?
Oh, no, no. You can't just go around naming people other things because you don't like their real name."
"I like Blue just fine," Gansey said. He didn't believe she was really offended.
Her face didn't look like it had at Nino's when they'd first met, and her ears were turning pink. He thought possibly he was getting a little better at not offending her, although he couldn't seem to stop teasing her. "Some of my favorite shirts are blue. However, I also like Jane."
"I'm not answering to that."
"I didn't ask you to." Opening the door of the Camaro, he pushed the driver's seat forward. Adam obediently climbed in the back. Blue pointed at Gansey.
"I'm not answering to that."
But she got in. Ronan retrieved his MP3 player from the BMW before getting into the passenger seat, and even though the pig's aftermarket CD player wasn't really working, Ronan kicked the dash until a loudly obnoxious electronic track came on. Gansey tugged open the driver's side door. Really, he should be making Ronan do his homework before Aglenby kicked him out. But instead, he shouted for Noah one last time and then climbed into the car. "Your sense of what constitutes cool music is frightful," he told Ronan. From the back seat, Blue shouted, "Does it always smell like gasoline?"
"Only when it's running," Gansey called back.
"Is this thing safe?"
"Safe as life."
Adam shouted,
"Where are we going?"
"Gelato. Also, Blue's going to tell us how she knew where the ley line was," Gansey said. "We're going to strategize and decide what the next move is, and we're going to pick Blue's brain about energy. Adam, you're going to tell me everything you remember about time and ley lines. And Ronan, I want you to tell me again what you'd found out about dream time and song lines. Before we go back there again, I want to find out everything we can about making sure it's safe." But that wasn't what happened. What happened was they drove to Harry's and parked the Camaro next to an Audi and a Lexus, and Gansey ordered flavors of gelato until the table wouldn't hold any more bowls, and Ronan convinced the staff to turn the overhead speakers up, and Blue laughed for the first time at something Gansey said. And they were loud and triumphant and kings of Henrietta because they'd found the ley line and because it was starting. It was starting. 25. Gansey, energized, sent the boys out on Glendower-related tasks for the next 3 days, and to Adam's surprise, Blue managed to come along for each of them. Though she never said as much, it was clear she was keeping them a secret, because she never contacted the boys by phone or met up with them near 300 Fox Way. Despite their lack of formal planning and psychic ability, they all had schedules largely dictated by school, so they managed to meet up to explore with remarkable precision. Exploring, however, did not include going back to the strange wood. Instead, they spent time at the courthouse finding out who owned the land underneath the Raven, looking up microfiche in the Henrietta Library, trying to determine if the strange wood had a name, discussing the history of Glendower, marking the ley line on the map, measuring how wide it seemed to be, tramping around in fields, turning over rocks, making circles of stones and measuring the energy that came from them. They also ate a lot of cheap food from convenience stores. This was Blue's fault. After that first triumphant gelato party, Blue insisted on paying for all of her food herself, which limited where they could eat. She despised when any of the boys tried to buy food for her, but she seemed to hate it the most when Gansey offered. At one store, Gansey had started to pay for Blue's potato chips, and she'd snatched them away. "I don't want you to buy me food," Blue said. "If you pay for it, then it's like I'm beholden to me," Gansey suggested pleasantly. "Don't put words in my mouth." "It was your word. You assumed it was my word. You can't just go around assuming." "But that is what you meant, isn't it?" She scowled. "I'm done with this conversation." Then Blue had bought her own chips, though it was clear the price was dear to her and nothing to Gansey. Adam was proud of her. After the first day, too, Noah came with them, and this also pleased Adam, because Noah and Blue got along well. Noah was a good bellwether for people. He was so shy and awkward and invisible that he could be easily ignored or made fun of. Blue was not only kind to him, but actually seemed to get along with him. Strangely enough, this relieved Adam, who felt like Blue's presence among them was largely his doing. He now so rarely made decisions without Gansey or Ronan or Noah that he doubted his judgment when he acted alone.
The days slid easily by, with the five of them doing everything but returning to the strange pool and the dreaming tree. Gansey kept saying, "We need more information." Adam told Blue, "I think he's afraid of it." He knew he was. The ever-pervasive vision he'd had in the tree kept creeping into his thoughts. Gansey, dead, dying, because of him. Blue looking at Adam, shocked. Ronan crouched beside Gansey, his face miserable, snarling. "Are you happy now, Adam? Is this what you wanted?" Was it a dream? Was it a prophecy? Gansey told Adam, "I don't know what it is." Historically, this phrase had been a very good way of losing Adam's respect. The only way to counteract admitting to not knowing something was to immediately follow it with the words, "But I'll find out." Adam didn't give people much time to find out, only as much time as he'd give himself. But Gansey never let him down. They'd find out what it was. Only, Adam wasn't sure this time that he wanted to know. By the end of the second week, the boys had settled into a routine of waiting for Blue at the end of the school day, then setting off into whatever mission Gansey had assigned them. It was an overcast spring day that felt more like fall, cold and damp and steel gray. While they waited, Ronan decided to finally take up the task of teaching Adam how to drive a stick shift. For several minutes, it seemed to be going well as the BMW had an easy clutch. Ronan was brief and to the point with his instruction, and Adam was a quick study with no ego to get in the way. From a safe vantage point beside the building, Gansey and Noah huddled and watched as Adam began to make ever quicker circles around the parking lot. Every so often, their hoots were audible through the open windows of the BMW. Then, it had to happen eventually. Adam stalled the car. It was a pretty magnificent beast as far as stalls went, with lots of noise and death spasms on the part of the car. From the passenger seat, Ronan began to swear at Adam. It was a long, involved swear, using every forbidden word possible, often in compound word form. As Adam stared at his lap, penitent, he mused that there was something musical about Ronan when he swore, a careful and loving precision to the way he fit the words together. A black-painted poetry. It was far less hateful-sounding than when he didn't swear. Ronan finished with, "For the love of Parrish, take some care. This is not your mother's 1971 Honda Civic." Adam lifted his head and said, "They didn't start making the Civic until 73. There was a flash of fangs from the passenger seat, but before Ronan truly had time to strike, they both heard Gansey call warmly, "Jane, I thought you'd never show up. Ronan is tutoring Adam in the ways of manual transmissions." Blue, her hair pulled every which way by the wind, stuck her head in the driver's side window. The scent of wildflowers accompanied her presence. As Adam catalogued the scent in the mental file of things that made Blue attractive, she said brightly, "Looks like it's going well. Is that what that smell is?" Without replying, Ronan climbed out of the car and slammed the door. Noah appeared beside Blue. He looked joyful and adoring, like a Labrador retriever. Noah had decided almost immediately that he would do anything for Blue, a fact that would have needled Adam if it had been anyone other than Noah. Blue permitted Noah to pet the crazy tufts of her hair, something Adam would have also liked to do, but felt would mean something far different coming from him. "Okay, let's go," Gansey said. He was being theatrical about it, flipping open his journal, checking his watch, waiting for someone to ask him where they were going. Through the car window, Adam asked, "Where today?" Gansey swept up a backpack from the ground. "The wood." Blue and Adam looked at each other, startled. "Time," Gansey said grandly, striding past them toward the Camaro, "is wasting." Blue jumped back as Adam scrambled from the driver's seat of the BMW. She hissed to him, "Did you know this?" "I didn't know anything." "We have to be back in 3 hours," Ronan said. "I just fed Chainsaw, but she'll need it again." "This," Gansey replied, "is precisely why I didn't want to have a baby with you." They bundled into the car with the comfort of routine, climbing into the Camaro, though all logic suggested they take the BMW instead. Ronan and Gansey scuffled briefly over his keys. Gansey won, as he won everything. Adam, Blue, and Noah climbed into the tiny back seat in that order. Noah shrank up the side of the car, trying desperately not to touch Blue. Adam didn't take quite so much care. For the first 10 minutes on the first day, Adam had been polite, but it quickly became clear that Blue didn't mind when his leg touched hers. Adam was all right with that. Everything was the same as before, but for some reason, Adam's heart was thumping. New spring leaves jerked from the trees by the suddenly cold wind scurried across the lot. He saw goosebumps through the loopy crochet cardigan Blue wore. She reached to take a handful of both his shirt and Noah's and tugged them both to her like blankets. "You're always cold, though, Noah," she said. "I know," he replied, bleak. Adam wasn't certain what came first with Blue, her treating the boys as friends or them all becoming friends. It seemed to Adam that this circular way to build relationships required a healthy amount of self-confidence to undertake. And it was a strange sort of magic that it felt like she'd always been hunting for Glendower with them. With his shoulder pressed against Blue's crocheted one, Adam leaned forward between the two front seats and asked, "Gansey, don't we have any heat?" "If it starts." The engine was turning over, 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 over. Adam felt cold enough for his teeth to chatter, though there was no way that the temperature was that low. He was cold on the inside. He ordered, "Gas! Give it more gas." "That is, with gas." Ronan punched Gansey's right leg down, his palm on Gansey's knee. The engine wailed high and caught. Gansey dryly thanked Ronan for his assistance. "Your heart," Blue said in Adam's ear. "I can feel it in your arm. Are you nervous?"
"It's just," he replied, "I'm not sure where we're going."
Because they were traveling by Camaro, not by helicopter, it took longer to get to the coordinates Gansey had marked in his journal. When they arrived, parking the car at an empty vacation cabin and walking the rest of the way, they found the woods had a far different character under a cloudy sky. The raven was stark and dead among the grass, bony white shells in the foliage. The trees at the forest's edge seemed taller than before, giants, even among the towering mountain trees. Everything was in shadow on the sunless day, but the stretch of scrubby grass at the edge of the forest seemed darker still. Adam's heart was still a flighty thing. He had to confess to himself that until now he probably had never really believed Gansey's supernatural explanation for the ley line, not in a way that he'd really internalized. Now, it was real. Magic existed, and Adam didn't know how much that changed the world. For a long moment, they all silently stared into the woods as if facing an adversary. Gansey rubbed a finger over his lip. Blue clutched her arms around herself, jaw clenched with the cold. Even Ronan seemed disquieted. Only Noah looked as he always did, his arms loose, shoulders hunched. "I feel watched," Blue said finally. Gansey replied, "High EMF readings can do that. Haunting cases have often come down to old, exposed wiring. High readings can make you feel watched. Unnerved, nauseous, suspicious. It plays with the hardwiring of your brain." Noah tipped his head far back to look at the slowly moving tops of the trees. It was the opposite of Adam's instinct, which was to search between the trunks of the trees for movement. "But," Adam added, "it can go the other way, too. High readings can give spirits the power they need to manifest, right? So you are more likely to be watched or haunted even as you're feeling watched or haunted," Gansey said. "And of course water can reverse that, too. Makes EMF and energy into positive feelings." "Hence," Ronan chipped in not to be outdone, "all the healing springs crap out there." Blue rubbed her arms. "Well, the water's in there, not out here. Are we going in?" The trees sighed. Gansey narrowed his eyes. "Are we invited?" Adam asked.
I think, Noah replied, you invite yourself. He was the first to step in.
Ronan muttered angrily, probably because Noah, had more courage than any of them. He plunged in after him.
Wait, Gansey looked at his watch. It's 4:13. We need to remember that later. He followed Noah and Ronan in.
Adam's heart pounded. Blue stretched out her hand and he took it.
Don't crush your fingers, he thought.
And they went in. Under the canopy, it was even dimmer than in the field. The shadows beneath fallen trees were flat black, and the trunks were painted in chocolate, charcoal, onyx.
Noah, whispered Gansey.
Noah, where did you go?
Noah's voice came from behind them.
I didn't go anywhere.
Adam spun, still clutching Blue's hand, but there was nothing there but branches quivering in the faint breeze.
What did you see? Gansey asked.
When Adam turned back, Noah was standing just ahead of Gansey.
Plays with the hard wiring of your brain.
Nothing?
Ronan, a hunched black shape a few yards off, asked,
Where are we going?
Anywhere but that tree, Adam thought. I don't want to see that again.
Gansey poked in the dirt for signs of the stream they'd followed before.
Back the same way, I guess. Proper experiment recreates the conditions, doesn't it? The creek's shallower this time, though.
Harder to see.
It wasn't far, was it? They'd only been walking along the shallow stream bed for a few minutes, however, when it became apparent that the landscape was unfamiliar. The trees were tall, thin, and spindly, all slanted as if from some great wind. Great crags of rock shoved up from the poor soil. There was no sign of the stream bed, the pool, the dreaming tree.
We've been misdirected, Gansey said. His tone was at once blunt and accusatory, as if the wood itself had done it.
Also, Blue pointed out, dropping Adam's hand, did you notice the trees?
It took Adam a moment to realize what she meant. A few of the leaves that clung to the branches were still pale yellow, but now it was the yellow of fall, not spring. Most of the leaves that surrounded them were the dusky red-green of shifting autumn. The leaf litter at their feet was brown and orange, leaves killed by the early frost of a winter that shouldn't be near. Adam was torn by wonder and anxiety.
Gansey, he said, what time do you have?
Gansey twisted his wrist. It's 5:27 p.m., second hand still running. In a little over an hour, they'd walked through two seasons. Adam caught Blue's eye. She just shook her head. What else was there to do?
Gansey, Noah called. There's writing over here.
On the other side of a rock outcropping, Noah stood by a great block of chin-height stone. Its face was sheared and cracked, striated with lines like Gansey's lay sketches. Noah pointed at a few dozen words painted low on the rock. Whatever ink the author had used, it was worn and uneven, black in some places, deep plum in others.
What language is that? Blue asked.
Adam and Ronan answered as one.
Latin.
Ronan crouched swiftly by the rock.
What does it say? Gansey asked.
Ronan's eyes darted back and forth as he scanned the text. Unexpectedly, he smirked.
It's a joke. This first part. The Latin is pretty crappy.
A joke? Gansey echoed. About what?
You wouldn't find it funny.
The Latin was difficult, and Adam gave up trying to read it. Something about the letters, however, disturbed him. He couldn't put his finger on it. The very shape of them. Warily, he asked, Why is there a joke written on a random stone?
The mirth had run out of Ronan's face. He touched the words, traced the letters. His chest rose and fell, rose and fell.
Ronan? Asked Gansey.
There's a joke, Ronan answered finally, not looking away from the words, in case I didn't recognize my own handwriting.
This, Adam realized, was what had distressed him about the words.
Now that it had been pointed out, it was obvious that the handwriting was Ronan's. It was just so out of context, painted on this rock with an arcane pigment, smudged and worn by the weather.
"I don't understand," Ronan said. He kept tracing and retracing the letters. He was badly shaken.
Gansey rallied. He couldn't bear to see any of his number rattled. Voice firm, like he was certain, like he was lecturing on world history, he said, "We saw before how the ley line played with time. We can see it right now on my watch. It's flexible. You haven't been here before, Ronan, but it doesn't mean you didn't come here later. Minutes later. Days, years, leave yourself a message, write a joke so you'd believe it was you. Knowing there was a chance, time might fold you here to find it."
Well done, Gansey, Adam thought.
Gansey had crafted his explanation to steady Ronan, but Adam too felt more reasonable. They were explorers, scientists, anthropologists of historical magic. This was what they wanted.
Blue asked, "Then what does it say after the joke?"
"Arbores loqui latine," Ronan replied. "The trees speak Latin."
It was meaningless, a riddle perhaps, but nonetheless Adam felt the hairs of his neck crawl. They all glanced at the trees that surrounded them. They were fenced by 1,000 different shades of green, fastened to 1,000,000 wind-blown claws.
"And the last line?" Gansey asked. "That last word doesn't look like Latin."
"Nomine appellant," Ronan read. "Call it by name." He paused. "Cabe's water."
26. "Cabe's water," Gansey repeated. There was something about the word itself that was magical. "Cabe's water." Something old and enigmatic, a